Hello.
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 Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Behind the Scenes with Brian, the podcast covering everything from engineering, mining, and mine waste management to whatever else may be on our minds. Pop in your headphones and don't forget to rate, subscribe, and share. And now, here is your host, Brian Ulrich.
Hey everyone, this is Brian, and this is Behind the Scenes with Brian. Today I'm joined by Lindsay Newland Bowker. Lindsay, how are you today?
Great. Nice to see you, Brian.
Yeah, and you as well. And you're in Maine. What part of Maine?
Well, I live on a very beautiful island, sort of near the federal park here, near Acadia National Park. But it's its own little thing. It's sort of a fishing village that's also been a home for artists internationally for hundreds of years.
Wow.
Marin and many other painters painted here. And so we still have that sort of hybrid culture of lobstermen, clam diggers, and famous artists. It's kind of a cool place.
It sounds tranquil and quaint.
I guess. It's unique. Unique and beautiful.
Yeah, I bet it is. Lindsay, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your education.
Well, it's sort of an esoteric Forrest Gump kind of story.
Okay.
It was not mining is the last chapter in a 50-year career in public policy.
Okay.
That's mainly been about being asked to look at very complex problems that were affecting all of New York City or, you know, certain whole segments of the population, and being sent out to document it, things that people didn't know anything about. One of the first things I was asked to do was John Lindsay asked me to explain what was going on with gentrification in New York City. And I came back with a very different story and data than he expected. I mean, he was looking for and expecting that gentrification meant free renewal with no public investment.
Oh my.
And I came back and said, well, yeah, that's true, but for every brownstone you turn over, you're displacing 10 people who have no place else to live and no income. And that's kind of the story of my career, because I was taught as a youngster by my father, who only told me four rules of life: seek the truth, tell the truth, do your best, and pay attention. That's what my father taught me.
Okay.
Good
lessons.
Well, they've served me well. So they've sort of led me through. I've loved all my work. I've loved tackling all the problems I've tackled in my life. And I was kind of set up for that by accidentally landing at a very experimental college that John Dewey was doing through the New School of Social Research. And I didn't even understand that the New School of Social Research didn't actually have an undergraduate program. That's the Forrest Gump part. I just landed there. And it taught critical thinking, which was already pretty popular in some schools in England.
Yeah, okay.
And it just fit very naturally with my father's four basic rules of life, and taught me to see things beyond the narrative that competing interests in any public policy situation try to convince you is the whole truth. And it just, you know, set me up for a really wonderful career. I've loved unraveling every problem I've ever tackled. I've been blessed with support from some of the greatest intellectual and technical talent in the world. All my work at City Planning was sort of personally tutored between IBM and MIT.
Okay.
So top people at both institutions were sort of honing me and teaching me how to use how to enable people to use a then evolving technology, the computer, to bring out from within themselves their own expertise and engage the computer and the software that I was developing and that we were building together to do their own inquiries. And so that's a great setup and a great and very much the heart. I think you've seen a little bit of my work. It's very much the heart of how I do any public policy issue. Mm-hmm, and to me, mining is the most complex of any public policy issue I've ever tackled. And that's why I come to it in a character that's sort of outside the dogma and teachings and discipline of each of the critical components that shape both the opportunity and the problems that we're facing together around mining now.
Okay, so Lindsay, tell me about the company that you work for now.
Well, I don't work, I created this company.
Okay.
It's a nonprofit. It is funded. I don't seek donations. I don't do fundraising. But I try to bring in the brightest and the best people like Bob Moran, people like that, to explore problems like the work I just shared with you recently on how I'm looking at the Telfer shutdown because of the mining, because of the tailings problem. That's how I work. So I explore it. I piece together the pieces that define the whole history, not just the crack in the wall of the TSF, but how we got to the crack in the wall in the TSF and what it means going forward if there's a failure risk and how to prevent it. I don't think you can accept money for this kind of work unless it's no strings money. It has to be just people who understand the work, see its value, and make donations on that basis. But it can't be sort of agreeing under a funded umbrella to look at a problem like Telfer and to look at what it really means, or to look at the real failure story behind any of the 300 failures I've documented in my database. 353, I think, is the count at the moment.
Yeah, amazing. What do you remember the oldest tailings failure that's in your database?
I have to look it up, but it goes back. I initially adopted the kind of shabby list that the Eichel 221 bulletin put together. And as Steve Vick explained to me, that was really work he had done for U.S. Cold with a sort of ad hoc contribution from the long list of other people that were involved. So it was not complete, it was not thorough, and it didn't have any detail. And those are completely, they're identified in my database. I identify the original list. And for a lot of those, so some of them go way back, like Buffalo Creek was pretty early, and some of them were even, and I've built on them. I've done a lot of work on Buffalo Creek. I just did a memorial piece on Buffalo Creek on the anniversary a few years ago. So there's always more to be learned and told. But the further back you go before 1990, the more sketchy everything is, because we didn't have computers. I mean, when I was doing my work at City Planning, it was nobody even knew what computers were, what they could do, or they certainly didn't have little things on there and a little tiny device where they could access the computer.
Right.
Imagine. So it's constantly evolving. And I keep Google alerts. That's how I keep my work mainly. I keep Google alerts on the names, keywords and key names of places. And it's amazing how much, and I will research the web periodically, especially around an anniversary time for an event, to see if anything new is developed, because a lot of geotechnical people go back through history and you find occasionally really intriguing new studies and new perspectives on really old failures. So they're constantly teaching us, but only to the extent that people have reached back and tried to understand that failure in a new context. And I try to capture it in my database as time goes on.
Yeah, just keeping on the topic of Buffalo Creek, people nowadays, when we think of disasters, it's Mary Spray, Brumadinho, Stava, but Buffalo Creek was just as horrible as any of those. I think there was more than 100 people killed. But people don't think about Buffalo Creek. Would you give us a little reminder of the incident?
Well, it was a complete surprise to everybody there.
Yeah.
It was like Stava and several other, to some extent, like Mariana, the San Marco failure, because the entire flow is channeled down a very narrow gorge. So the force of that, you know, from a high elevation to lower elevations along a narrow channel, was just unimaginable. And the whole town, everybody was engaged in mining. It was part of everybody's life. It had been part of everybody's life for generations. So the physical images, and I included the, I'll send you my memoriam for that. Had just amazing images of people standing there and just watching people they knew, buildings they knew, just flow by in this rush. And there's no recovery from any of these. The only way to look at the failure record and look at the scale of devastation is to look at it, as I'm trying to do now, preventively. From I'm a risk manager, I'm a chartered property and casualty underwriter. And a certified risk manager. So the only way to look at these things is to how to prevent them, because you can find correcting things is pretty cheap compared to avoiding the truth of their happening and letting it happen.
Right. Yeah, I think all of the failures that we talked about were preventable, and people had the skills and the knowledge and the tools at the time of the failures. Even going back, like you said, Stava, you know, it was, the problems weren't complex. They just weren't understood by either the operators or the engineers. They didn't have
Well, that's how Norby Morgenstern describes it in his written works, and that's how Mike Davies and Vic and other people describe it. But it's deeper than that. You know, mining has a very ancient culture of accepting the premise that a local catastrophe a sacrifice song was the actual word used in Grace Metallica. Was inevitable, but that they were like lambs sacrificed for a greater benefit and a greater good. So it was sort of accepted that the product of it, having the metals that the world needed, whether for glamour or for defense or for economic development, warranted the local costs. So there was no examination of it. And also, I put that question directly to some of these not to Dr. Morgenstern, but to a pretty high level cast of other characters. I said, how could you guys have been setting all these standards that are so true? I mean, they bear out as true today, all these years later, and yet they still happen. And the story I got back, or the feedback I got back, is, well, we just loved the work. We weren't trying to educate people out in the field. That wasn't our mission at all. We were just fascinated to learn this stuff. And we shared it occasionally in written works, but we weren't out to correct anything or to educate anything. You know, we didn't go back out and say, okay, we have to redo the curriculum at every mining school in the world, and we have to retrain all the professors, and we have to tell them all new stuff. That wasn't their motivation. That wasn't their purpose. They just loved the work, and they loved the discovery. And so that's a very difficult, those two things make it a very difficult place to evolve change from.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about things that are so, so entrenched and accepted as fundamental, a given, ordinary to the endeavor of mining.
Lindsay, can you give us an example of some of the work that you've done?
You mean other than mining?
Oh, no, in mining.
Well, the very first piece I did was local, and that's how I met David Chambers. J.D. Irving, do you know the Irving Company? They're a pretty big engineering company. They owned this mountain in Maine, and that piece of land that they owned wasn't earning very much. So they wanted to add value to this land by mining it.
Okay.
And Maine has no mining history. Well, it does. We have a super farm. Our only endeavor is a Superfund site now. And so I was brought into it because I had pro bono helped community groups fend off a highway right through the middle of Maine, and a whole bunch of gas tanks in an existing gas tank farm that it would have caused massive losses. So those same people came to me when they heard about this mountain being put forward for mining, and that's how I got involved. And that's actually how I got to know all these folk, because I just started, dialing. Hey, here's what they're doing. And
What do you have to lose by making a phone call? Not a lot.
Right. And people were really interested. I mean, people at the USGS and people like Bob Moran, I didn't reach out to David Chambers. I had no idea who he was. But I found all these other people that are still my sort of main go-to. Mm-hmm, do I understand this correctly? Did I say it right? Is this right?
Exactly.
People. And that battle is still going on. And it's very typical of what happens when NGOs try to take the reins and solve the problem. I mean, without NGOs, we would still accept the premise that a local sacrifice zone is inevitable. But the agenda that they came up with out of their work, their solutions, don't show any understanding of where mining is right now, how big the problem is, and what is practically available and possible to change the outcome. So we've got a terrible hodgepodge of laws, legislation. I mean, did you see, for example, the court? I read all the court papers too, because I'm very interested in how law ends up not solving these problems. The loudmouths that go before committees and go before legislators are not the people that actually have the answers or understand the problem. They're the people that have documented that children die from mercury or lead or asbestos. And they don't know what the solutions are, because they don't know where that thing, the lead paint, the asbestos, fits into the environment. They don't get it. So they end up writing really ridiculous laws that frustrate resolution of the problem and don't really contribute to it. And that just showed up in a court decision on PolyMet. I don't know if you read that court decision. It literally made me sort of pace my porch up and down. It's so crazy, you know, because the environmentalists got what they saw as the keys to the kingdom in the statute, but the people applying the statute in courts and in legal decisions don't understand what those words mean or what that really encompasses. So if you read that court piece, it would really, you'd probably be pacing your room too if you read it. So we're not getting the pieces put together. My piece, you asked the question, what was my work? So my original work was to map whether the incidents that were happening that were very serious were insurable. I'm an insurance expert. I mean, I was on the cover of Business Insurance all the time, and I was quoted in business. I'm an expert in property and casualty insurance.
Okay.
And it was obvious as soon as I put all this data, that's where the database came from, that original inquiry.
Okay.
So I took that horrible version of world failures from ICOL Bulletin 221.
Yeah.
And I hope Harvey McLeod hears this. Anyway. pulled together other data that wasn't in there and made the best first cut at a true world database I could.
Yeah.
And built additional parameters where you could actually do some serious mathematical work.
Mm-hmm.
So my first piece of work showed very clearly that these were a result of false understandings about growing the resource through open cut mining and low grade near surface deposits. I mean, that was just a completely false premise that sort of swept through the industry. It had no basis at all. It's like the stuff that goes on TikTok on the internet now. It just sort of, it's like just rumor. Everybody said, oh, that's a good idea. Let's all do that. So my first piece established very clearly that that the trend was continuing, and that the causes were not what is a term of art called insurable risk. So an insurable risk is something that is either an act of God that's not foreseeable or preventable, or where a prudent person engaged in that endeavor could not reasonably understand that there might be a consequence from his actions. So I immediately told David Chambers, none of these are insurable risks. You can buy an insurance policy, that is for, you know, huge amount of millions of dollars and pay through the nose for it, as Mount Polly was for years. Yep. But when the accident happens, you're only going to get a payment if the cause of the event meets that standard, an insurable risk. Yep. So did Mount Polly ended up losing, I think it was it 200, they were denied, was it 250 million? They were denied on their property insurance for the dam itself. And that's why my focus is on prevention, because those are all, if something isn't an insurable risk, by definition, it's preventable. You know, it's like the yin and yang. It's not an insurable risk. It's an event that could have been prevented.
Well, you know, I can easily say that those incidents could have been prevented, and the industry knew. Well, that's with a lot of hindsight. You know, the expert panels went in and spent a lot of money and a lot of efforts, and they found these things that were the causes, but for a consulting company to go in on kind of a meager budget to try to overcome those things, it's a challenge.
I'm not sure. Well, I'm not quite sure I agree with that, because the issues at Mount Paul, I just happened to last night, in the context of the work I'm doing now on ring dike dams, and are they different? Do they perform differently on my TOEFL work?
Yeah.
And I don't know how it happened, but I ended up rereading the entire Mount Polly.
Yeah, the expert.
The expert opinion, the first one. And of course, now I know a lot more about it than I did when I wrote up the failure thing. But no, everything about Mount Polly was clear from the beginning. It's not a question like, you know, they vetted a source, a new source, when they reopened Mount Polly. It should never have been vetted. If they had done their homework up front, they would have seen that it was, a PAG-producing resource. And they would have seen that they were not going to have the material that they needed to continue the design, the centerline design that they had planned as of those first raises. And they didn't make any adjustments to the design except to do a setback that was temporary. And Knight Piesold didn't agree to that. They didn't agree to that at all, to continue that. They agreed to it for that first raise, but they didn't agree to it. And he just wouldn't listen, because he was operating on a shoestring. He had nothing. He didn't have Shimamoto anymore as his funding partner. He had bought them out, you know, to go solo. So they don't come to you by surprise. And it's not like people come in. It's a series. It's a chain of wrong decisions that were, you know, avoidable, but that have consequences. That's why I'm interested in TOEFL, because although TOEFL is small in consequence now that it's part of the larger portfolio, but for Newcrest, it was significant. If that had happened under Newcrest's watch, it would have been very significant that TOEFL was shut down for operations. But under Newmont, there's a possibility that it can be one of those dams that we save from failure.
Yeah. You mentioned that it's usually a series of bad decisions that leads to these things. And that reminds me, there's an author that calls that drift. I can't remember the name of the author.
Calls it what?
Drift, like driftwood. Drift.
Oh, I've never heard that phrase. You know what Steve Vick called it.
What?
He called it the tolerance of deviance.
Oh, yeah. Same thing. Same thing, yeah. So you can imagine, you know, you're playing golf and you hit your tee shot and it goes, drifts off to the right just a little bit, but you're pretty happy. Still in the fairway, you go down, you hit it again and it drifts off a little bit more. You're still happy, you know, it's a par five hole. You hit it again and it's on the wrong fairway. So that's drift. So you're not unhappy with any one of those single shots, but it's the end result of all that drift that leads you into the wrong place.
But it's also, that's why I like being at, I've always ignored LinkedIn. I didn't understand what it was. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to, you know, pay any attention to anything. And I still find it a not very fruitful place to be. But at least it has put me in touch directly with a community of engineers, of people that are not at Vic's level and not at Morgan Stern's level and not at Van Zyl's level. And these are the people that are actually out there at the site doing the best that they understand can be done. And the people in the boardroom don't really pay any attention to them. It's not like they care what they're doing out there. They just want to make sure they got a place to dump their tailings, you know?
Yeah.
So they're isolated. So I now see the comment that the people who made up these still perfectly true rules, like the 10 commandments of upstream construction, they weren't really out in the ditches. Steve Vick was never really out in the ditches like these guys at LinkedIn are.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking at what was going on as the end result of, you know, what happened in the boardroom and what was going on. A good example is Jagger Swanton. I haven't had a chance to write it up yet. I've done a little public writing on it. But
this is, you're talking about the South African dam that failed two or 3 years ago?
No, this was this year. It was just this last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
And when you look at, when you really map the whole event, you know, it's just unbelievable. And the people that were set up as the site engineers don't know anything about mining or let alone tailings management.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to be doing thickening, and they just assumed that thickening would work the same as it did at another De Beers mine where remining was happening quite successfully with thickening. And from day one, they weren't getting thickened tailings.
Mm.
Yet one of the top engineers in the world, I shan't name them, they know who they are, weren't going to the site, and they were still representing in papers to the regulator that the tailings were thickened to a specific level. That was the level that was being achieved at another site, not this site.
Yeah.
And so what destroyed Jagger Swanton was, you know, poor technical competence at the mining level. It's not like they were people that had trained to be mining engineers that were in charge of it. And it's just impossible to understand how it could have gone that far without ever producing any thickened tailings at all. So they were basically putting permanently suspended liquid in upstream tailings built with tailings material, not even rock fill. I mean, they didn't even change it to rock fill. So how do you fix a problem like that? It's very, very tough. That's my work, is mapping every problem like a system. So you don't just go to the last part like they do in cause of failure analysis. They go to proximate cause, it's called in risk management work. The last event before the big event that caused the big event. But you can't solve problems that way. You have to go back all through everything that got to that moment to really understand what happened and how to prevent it. Because if you don't map the inputs and outputs correctly, you can't intervene in the system and have a different output.
Are there key takeaways from your database, or is it kind of each one of those is individual and you have to look at them one by one?
Well, of course, every single event is unique.
Yeah.
Every mine is unique.
Yeah.
But mathematically, which is what I did, using all of my super fancy multivariate analysis skills, and proving every point, proving that, yes, it actually meets the criteria to apply something that assumes a normal distribution. I mean, I really dotted every I and crossed every T.
Okay.
You can put that into the works and decide whether the data say anything. It might not say everything, and it's not going to say how the failure got to be that big. But I said everything could possibly be said about the failures, and it was very clear that they were attributable to mines that were well below grade. You know, that there is a current dominant grade. And in mining, it's not like going to a discount store and paying less for something that's slightly bent. there's a fixed price out there. So you're still only going to get X dollars a pound or X dollars or whatever. And to try to make a mine that's that far below grade be profitable at a given fixed price that applies no matter what it actually costs to achieve it at your particular site. So my math does get into that, because I did in fact prove that Mount Polly, for example, all the mines that failed in that supercycle phase were subgrade, that relative to prevailing market grade. So they just were, and if you look historically at the data documenting these mines and the work that was done to say that they were going to be profitable, they were not profitable at current prevailing. So all those super fund open cast mines, subgrade, needed $3 a pound for copper, for example, to be viable. Well, it never hit that through the whole super cycle. So there are economics to the situation that developers and the junior miners who vet these sites don't really pay attention to that. That was my other thing. I was a banking commissioner for 10 years. I don't think I was appointed by Mario Cuomo to be a representative for consumers and communities on the board. It was one of the very first times that people like me had been there, and he asked me specifically to do it. So, and the banking industry itself was engaged in similar kinds of nonsense at the time. You know, it had thrown all this money into Latin American debt and didn't realize that they were never going to be able to get that money back. So the whole industry was in a big crisis. So it wasn't just about redline. It wasn't just about mortgage policies either being non-existent or specifically excluding inner city neighborhoods by their terms. It was more than that the industry itself had made the same kind of wildly crazy decisions like the mining industry had made on this venture into near surface deposits.
And of course, when you talk about those, you're talking about people that reduce costs one way or another by getting Guinea or here and there, and some of it probably had to do with safety and mine waste management. Mine waste management is not a money maker. It's a cost to the mine. So that's a place where they used to cut costs. I think we're doing a lot better. We had some unfortunate incidents that made people take a step back and say, maybe we need to pay a lot closer attention to these facilities.
Well, yeah, and my work was an important part of that. I mean, that work that I did, that first work in 2015, yeah, really showed that you could no longer after failure say, well, there was a lot of rain,
yeah,
you know, or there was an earthquake, or because those bring it under this thing called insurable interest.
Mm.
And the World Bank actually facilitated that. They did an absolutely horrible thing on the Markhopper failure in the Philippines. Because they need to get that insurance to, that has to pay off or their whole system falls apart if somebody yeah. doesn't get reimbursed. So they actually got the person, the bank ultimately owed the money to say publicly that they accepted that it was an act of God. And they did a whole big study after Markhopper, the World Bank. It's one of the most shameful pieces of public policy ever written. And they concluded that tailings failures are extremely rare and almost always acts of God in writing.
Yeah.
And that was the precursor to Bulletin 221. Yeah. And the mining industry liked that view, you know, yeah. they liked that view. So my sure. work was, my work was the first work that made it no shade at all on the premise that these are preventable. They're all preventable. None of them are acts of God.
That would be a very difficult thing to prove that something is an act of God.
Well, now you're talking theology, which I'm happy to talk
this is some
but
Old
that's
Testament.
The term of art. It's the term meaning a natural event.
Yeah, yeah.
But all natural events occur with a specific periodicity, and you're supposed to account for that. Like you don't build a house on a you know
on sandbar. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, on a sandbar. Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, this is nice. It's way out in the middle of the water. I'll put my house out here. So there's common sense involved in dealing with natural hazards and the kind of hazards that occur.
Yeah.
And act of God is just a term of art.
Sure. Still very hard to prove anything like that. Nobody could have seen this thing. Nobody in today's world could have seen this thing coming. That would be a very difficult thing to prove.
Well, except it ain't true, you know. Yeah. Because now we have, all through the 90s even, which is when the pattern of failure emerged as a thing of concern, because we had more information too.
Yeah.
We didn't have the same level of exchange, so people didn't know. That's why I bring to the fore, you know, failure events in rubies, in obscure places, in, you know, Mozambique and places like that, because it's all part of the world economy and it's all part yeah. of how minerals are sourced and produced in the world. And who consumes most of them? Canada, the US, Europe, you know, yeah. places like that.
Yeah, yeah. First world, right. Well, Lindsay, can you give us another example of work that you've done or work that you're even currently?
Well, my work on the economic, I'm a risk manager. My yeah. heart is in loss prevention and identifying risks early enough where intervention is cheap and doable.
Mm-hmm.
So my latest really significant work was for the International Study Group on Zinc and Lead for their annual meeting. It was 2022-23, and that's where my economics of de-risking work comes in.
Yep.
That piece was my presentation, invited presentation to them. And when I put numbers out, they're really unshakable. My numbers are not soft. My numbers are real.
Yeah.
They're hard. I spend hours and hours and hours rigorously, you know, shaking down those numbers to make sure they're the best numbers that anybody could come up with right now in the world. And nobody, I've never had anybody suggest that any number I've ever put out is questionable.
Yeah, good for you.
I'm good at it. That's what I was taught to do. I mean, I map complex problems through numbers. That's what I do.
Yeah. Okay. What makes you do the things that you do? You do it all pro bono. What drives you to do that?
Well, that's a good question. That's one I can't really answer. I don't know.
No.
I guess for this one, I mean, I've spent my whole life now, more than my whole professional life, which is now more than 50 years, tackling complex problems. And I always come back with an answer that's different. I had a consulting practice in the 80s. I got lured away from my planning, my city planning work, to look at child protective services. And just like when John Lindsay sent me out to map gentrification, when I was asked to look at child protective services, it turned out that what people understood to be children in need of protection wasn't at all what was actually in the caseload. They built a caseload and law around the idea that there were these crazy mothers sticking their children's hands in hot water to punish them. And so the whole system was built around, you know, taking children away from those mothers and putting them in foster care. I mapped the entire child protective caseload and showed that those cases were less than 2% of the entire caseload, and that the caseload was really female-headed households with no resources, no help, couldn't afford good housing, couldn't afford childcare, didn't have any training for jobs.
Yeah.
And same with my work when I came back into government in lead-based paint. Well, no, that was that work I did it at Environmental Protection. The government finally woke up to the fact that lead-based paint, which is the best paint you could possibly have, no paint makes color and lasts longer than lead-based paint. But all of a sudden we realized that people were dying from the prevalence of lead-based paint in the environment. And when I went out to look at the laws that had been passed, I saw that, that's true. Lead-based paint is everywhere and it's killing people everywhere, but you can't intervene in it this way. This law does not get us to a lead-free system of tanks and metal infrastructure. You know, you have to do something different.
Yeah.
So, It goes back to my daddy's seek the truth, speak the truth, do your best, and pay attention. So I can't help it. I guess that's what you could say. It's just how I am. It's just how I do things.
It satisfies you.
Oh my God, how could you call that satisfying? I mean...
I was going to say it makes you happy, but it's not just being happy.
I don't have any choice. It's what I do. I think every person has a talent.
Yeah.
Every child on Earth, wherever they're born, whatever they do, have an inner talent that the world needs. And some people have a chance to develop it and some people don't.
Yeah.
And I was uniquely blessed somehow to to have this talent noticed and developed by some of the brightest people in the world. And I sort of feel that I owe it to the world. This is what I'm supposed to do. So it's not, I don't get any pleasure out of it. I don't get any pleasure about the notoriety that I've gotten or the clout. I do have clout and influence. Yeah. You could ask anybody in tailings and they'll tell you that I have clout and influence, that what I say matters. I don't get any pleasure out of that part.
Yeah.
I get satisfaction out of the part that says the information I have brought to the world is truth. Carefully honed truth.
Yeah. That's great.
And that it matters to saving communities, saving water, saving lives. So I do it because I have to. I don't feel I have. I think if you have a great talent, I mean, can you imagine if some of the great musicians in the world decided, well, I don't care if I'm a great musician and I'm writing great music. I don't want to do that. I want to play golf.
Right.
So there's some mystical thing that allows talents that have been honed to serve the world to find a way into influencing how the world behaves. So I'm just an instrument. I'm not a creator. I'm just doing what I'm asked to do.
No, I think that's terrific. Well, Lindsay, we've covered a lot of topics today, and I've run out of questions for you. Was there something you wanted to talk about that we haven't already discussed?
No, I think that's fine.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate your time, and thanks for doing what you do.
Thank you. Thanks for doing what you do. I think it is... I think it is good to know a little bit about the people who are offering their opinions in the world.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks again, Lindsay, and all the best to you, and just wish the best for you.
Thank you. You take care, too.
Thanks.
Bye. Lindsay.
Bye.
Well, that's it. I'm Brian, and this is Behind the Scenes with Brian. Until next time, keep on rockin'.